From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Soldier, strategist, former Secretary of State. We're talking about retired General Colin Powell. Could this key Republican throw his support behind Democrat Barack Obama? And the U.S. Supreme Court rules Ohio election officials don't have to change the way new voter registrations are verified. We'll cover this and more on our Reporters Roundtable, and we begin with John Yearwood, World Editor at the Miami Herald. How are you?
Doing great, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. All right. MSNBC is reporting that retired general and former Secretary of State Colin Powell is going to go on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. They're speculating that the loyal Republican could endorse Senator Barack Obama for president. So at this point, so close to the election, how important would that support be?
Well, it would be extremely important. You know, just when we thought that most of the dramatic moments of this election had pretty much ended, here comes another big bombshell. I think anybody would be just thrilled, whether it's Obama or whether it's McCain, would be thrilled to get Powell's endorsement. You know, notwithstanding his conviction that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but I think he's still among the most credible of the folks out there who are yet to endorse. And I think maybe one clue that we got, Farai, in terms of where he may be leaning is that I don't remember seeing him at the Republican convention. I know you were there. You probably saw him. But I don't remember seeing him during that period.
I certainly don't remember seeing him. And I also do remember a point at a previous Republican convention where he was booed for making a remark about affirmative action. I don't know how much that stung him at the time. But this time around, I do remember a couple of moments from the conventions. One is Senator Fred Thompson, former Senator Fred Thompson, and former presidential candidate Fred Thompson, basically giving this incredible, reverent recounting of Senator John McCain's military service. But yet at the Democratic convention on the final night, they also had a parade of military officials who all supported Senator Barack Obama. So there's actually been some tussling over this. But how many... You know, what's the sense that you get? You are in the swing state of all swing states, the place where things blew up in the 2000 election. What's the sense that you get that there are undecided voters or undeclared voters in your state?
Well, I think that there are still a number of people. Indeed, that's why we're still out here swinging, if you will. But I believe that as we get closer and closer to the election, we'll see more and more people making up their minds. We're already seeing, if you look at the recent polls, that Senator Obama is doing very well in Florida, unlike what we saw Kerry do 4 years ago. As a result, President Bush won the state. But based on the ground game that we've been seeing here in Florida with Obama, it would be clearly it's a very tough state for Senator McCain to win. Senator McCain comes back to Florida. In fact, he's here today, and Senator Obama will be here on Monday, which gives you a sense that both of them really desperately think that Florida is a key to the White House for either of them.
I also want to bring in Chandra Thomas. She's a freelance print journalist based in Atlanta. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. So I want to move you to another topic. The election is, you know, a few weeks away, but the fight over battleground states, which we were just talking about with John, is fierce. Now, Republicans in Ohio were contesting as many as 200,000 newly registered voters. They argued that the names could not be verified with government lists, but the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and ruled that Ohio state officials don't have to change the way new voters are verified. What do you think the significance of that ruling is?
Oh, I think it definitely points to the importance of Ohio voters. And obviously in the 2004 election, it was a margin of 118,000 votes that won the state for President Bush. And obviously it lets you know that the election is heating up and that this is showing that there is going to be a hard fight to get those swing voters in Ohio.
John, Chandra just mentioned some of the issues that came up. And in fact, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, the congresswoman who passed away, was very adamant that the 2004 election really cheated Ohio voters, particularly voters of color and low-income voters. What do you see when you think about what's going on with Acorn And we'll go on a little bit more about the FBI investigation of that community activist group for their fraudulent voter registrations. But between ACORN and these challenges to the way voters are verified, what kind of positioning is going on for the 2008 election?
Well, look, Farai, I think it's really important, and here's what's key here, that everyone who's eligible to vote should be allowed to vote. Look, I live in Florida, where we know that didn't happen a few years ago. As a result, there was a decision in the election that a lot of people thought was not the way it should have been. What I'm seeing that ACORN did here is that if they went out with a plan to get as many people registered as possible and did it in a fraudulent way, then they should pay a penalty for that. But going forward, I think what the authorities in Ohio should strive to do at every turn in this is to get everyone who is eligible to vote and have those votes counted.
Chandra, I'm going to turn more deeply to the issue of ACORN. So the FBI is now investigating this community activist group, and officials report that they've registered 1.3 million people, and they really concentrate on people who are young, poor, working class. Most of them are Democrats. Republicans have been spearheading the investigations. And do you think, basically, there have been everything from fictitious names registered, including Mickey Mouse, to people who were registering people, they're being paid by the name and they got the same people to sign up again and again. Is this investigation partisan politics, or is it time to really dig in and hold the organization accountable?
Well, I think there's actually a mixture of both. As the other guest mentioned, it is important to make sure that there is no fraud and that, that people aren't signing up, Mickey Mouse, as you mentioned. But there's also a lot of other problems with ACORN, which is kind of like if they say people with glass houses should not throw rocks. You have the brother of the founder of ACORN embezzling almost $1 million from this group. And obviously that's going to draw attention to the legitimacy of this group. And I think this whole issue regarding voter registration, especially with the closeness of the election, this really points to the intensity of this race. And as we all know, this is probably the most important race of our lifetimes. So it's just really showing how intense the battle is for these votes as we get closer to the election.
John, when you think about the media coverage of ACORN, do you think that people are doing enough fact-checking? There certainly are investigative reporters out trying to nail the story down, but there's also a lot of opinion out there. How much of it is possibly getting mixed up in people's minds?
Let me say this for a minute about also the Supreme Court, and I'll come back to your question in a second. One of the things that I think we may have seen here signaled by the Supreme Court decision today in terms of saying that to let the voting proceed is that they're indicating that they may not want to get mixed up in the middle of another election fiasco as it did several years ago. But I think part of the reason why we're not seeing maybe the kind of saturation media coverage of this is that, to some extent, it is so bizarre. I think anyone trying to make sense of it, as you mentioned, Mickey Mouse, one of my favorite quarterbacks from Dallas, Tony Romo's name is one of the ones that was put on the list, as well as many other Dallas Cowboys. Where do you begin? It is so strange. And a lot of it is coming out. And as you indicated, a number of media outlets are investigating. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more of this in the days and weeks ahead.
Chandra, can you give us a quick read on another Supreme Court issue centering around Georgia? The U.S. Supreme Court this week refused to hear death row inmate Troy Davis's case. He was convicted of the 1989 murder of a Savannah police officer. And since that trial, 7 key witnesses recanted their testimony. So how is this playing in Georgia, and what options does Davis have right now?
I think that this case is extremely important because it points to a lot of concerns that have been raised about the death penalty. And if you look at the core of this case, basically, as you mentioned, 7 of 9 witnesses, you have the attorney, you have the district attorney basically saying, well, these witnesses were, you know, cross-examined, and we asked them during the trial whether they, you know, were they coerced by the police. And if you look at the core of this, what Troy Anthony Davis's family is asking for is just that a hearing be held just to speak to these witnesses who are willing to go on record and say that they have indeed, lied or, committed perjury. And I think the real importance of this issue is, are we at a state in this country where we are willing to take someone's life when there is a high level of question as to their guilt or innocence?
Right, John, very quickly, do you think that this is essentially over in terms of court intervention from the, from anyone who might change his state?
Yeah. It appears to be over, Fry, but sadly one has to ask, after this is done, and it seems that the execution is imminent, where does his mom go to get her son back? Where does his sister go to get her brother back? Before we execute anyone in this country, I think we have to be absolutely sure that the people we're executing committed the crime for which they're being put to death.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We were talking to John Yearwood, the world editor at the Miami Herald. He joined us from the studios at the newspaper. And Chandra Thomas, a freelance print journalist based in Atlanta. She's written for Essence Magazine, People, and Time.com. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. One person, one vote. It's the hallmark of our democracy and a right we hold dear. But there are millions of Americans who've lost that right because of a felony conviction. Getting the right to vote back is simple in some states and a lot more complicated in others. Today, we're going to take a look at the issues of felons voting. In a minute, we're going to talk to two people on separate sides of the issue. But right now with us, we've got Edward Grijalva. He got his voting rights back this spring after a decade of not being able to go to the polls. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So are you excited?
Yes. Well, as you know, it's been quite a while since I did vote, and this particular election, I think, is drawing more attention than the previous election. So, yes, I am.
All right. Can you tell us just briefly about your background and why you lost your voting rights?
Well, normally, I guess, in the state of Arizona, in any case, you lose your right to vote when you're convicted of a criminal offense, a felony offense, and you go to prison, then you lose your right to vote.
All right. Arizona is one of the states that doesn't automatically restore voting rights when you're released from prison. And so what do former felons in Arizona have to do to get their rights back?
Well, one of the problems is that most people aren't informed when they're released from prison. And depending on how many felonies they've had and the types of felonies that they've had, they normally would have to probably use a lawyer because the process isn't that simple. There's a project in Tucson through the University of Arizona law students, and they have a project called Restoration Rights, and it's headed by Jonathan Silverman. And that's how I got involved in this. Somebody sent me an email, and they did all the footwork for me. And so a lot of that is very difficult, especially for people who have limited education, and trying to understand the process is difficult for them. And so that's what happened with me.
Do you think it's fair for, and the states are all different in their laws, but do you think it's fair for people to have their voting rights taken away, particularly if it's almost impossible for them to get it back?
Of course not. I mean, I don't see, I don't even know where this all started, because apparently, I mean, my understanding is that this is a right and not a privilege, and what one has to do with the other is, I just can't seem to figure that out. I understand where, some of the limitations that you have is, you can't own a firearm, and that's for life. I can't own a firearm for life, although my crimes never involved a weapon of any sort. So, I mean, it's got all sorts of things caught up into it, but no. And one of the problems with that is that prison supposedly is a place where people get rehabilitated. And when people leave prison and they're attempting to enter into the larger society, it keeps them disconnected or disenfranchised. And I mean, if it's something that everybody else can do, what is the problem with somebody who's been convicted of a crime not being able to vote?
Do you think people care? And what I mean by that is that there's it couldn't be a more exciting time to be a new voter. But for people who are former felons, in many cases, there are a lot of issues on the table. Can you get a job? You know, a lot of job applications ask if you've been convicted of a felony. What are your prospects for reintegrating with your family? There's a lot of things on the table. How much do you think people who are former felons just, you know, reentering really put voting down as a priority?
That's one of the issues, and I don't think many of them do. Part of that is because, you have to look at the basic needs of people, like you said earlier. I mean, if you can't get a job, voting doesn't seem to be a priority. You need to eat, pay your rent, do whatever. And so, when those things are taken care of, voting does become important, and it should be important. And I think that's something that we really need to continue to educate ex-offenders as they're coming out of prison, that it is a right that you can have restored, and there is a process for doing that. And any help that we can offer to people that are having difficulty certainly is something that we can do for people. But for instance, this particular project that the University of Arizona has, I wouldn't have known about it had not somebody emailed me and said, look, this is going on. I think this would be something that would be helpful to you.
All right. Edward, you're now working as a drug treatment coordinator in Tucson. So, I mean, I don't know what you're allowed or not allowed to do, but do you ever talk with some of the folks that you're helping about the issue of voting and perhaps even the things that you went through to get your vote back?
We normally, of course we do, because our treatment process basically involves three main points. And that is, of course, the person remaining abstinent, clean and sober, taking a look. Number two, taking a look at their health. And the other one is what we call community. And in order to be part of community, of course, you have to hopefully get a job, support your family, get involved in the community. But that also involves having your rights restored. And voting is, part of that bigger piece of being part of the community. Otherwise, we ex-offenders will remain in that subculture that their mentality just kind of keeps them there if we don't push them in a different direction.
Well, Edward, appreciate you coming on the show and giving us your perspective. Take care.
Thank you very much.
That was Edward Grijalva. He recently had his voting rights restored after a decade, and he joined us from NPR Studios in Tucson, Arizona. Joining us now are two people who represent different sides, different policy positions on whether felons should vote. Kara Gotch is an advocacy director for the Sentencing Project, and David Mulhausen is a senior policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for coming on, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Kara, your organization has made this a big part of your 2008 efforts. And how do felon voting laws vary from state to state?
Well, it's quite a patchwork. You have states like Maine and Vermont, which allow people who are incarcerated in prison to vote. And then you have states like Virginia and Kentucky, which have lifetime bans on anyone with a felony conviction from voting, even once they've completed their sentence. The rest of the states and the District of Columbia fall in between, from states that disenfranchise while incarcerated but restore automatically once someone's released from prison, to other states that restore after completion of parole or probation, to some states that also have waiting periods for people. Even once they've completed their sentence, they must wait a set period of time before they can apply to get their voting rights back.
And what kind of resources are available? We just talked with Edward Grijalva, who got his voting rights restored, but it sounds like it wasn't easy, and he did have help. What kind of resources are there in states where they have more strict felony voting laws?
Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of resources. One of the biggest problems we see is the lack of information among people who are disenfranchised or people with felony convictions, and even among state election officials. The ACLU and the Brennan Center just recently released a report on de facto disenfranchisement, where they actually conducted surveys of Board of Election officials asking them what the voting rights laws were for people with felony convictions. And there are many circumstances where the state officials don't even know that someone with a felony conviction conviction can vote in that state, that they can vote once they're released from prison and not have to wait till the completion of their parole and probation. There needs to be serious notification of people who are with felony convictions to let them know what their rights are, and that unfortunately is not happening nationwide.
All right, David. What's your basic position or thought about whether or not felons should not be allowed to vote and for how long?
Well, I think that it needs to be decided on a state-by-state basis. And because, you know, felon disenfranchisement is part of a sanction for committing serious crimes. And every state has a method for felons to restore their voting rights.
What in general do you see as the value of delaying or preventing former felons from voting? I mean, if you see it as something that has some value in some states, what is that value?
Well, those convicted of certain felonies are less trustworthy. You know, for instance, we also deny felons their Second Amendment rights.
There was a professor from Johns Hopkins who runs a sex offender study group researching sex offenders, and obviously that's a very controversial issue where many smart people have differences of opinions. But what he found was that people who had more trouble, for example, finding an apartment because of their sex offender status, were actually more likely to go into recidivism because they felt like they didn't really have a stake in society as opposed to people who were able to reintegrate. Do you think there could be a boomerang effect where felons who don't vote actually feel less invested in American society?
I doubt that, because traditionally felons have not been concerned with the civil rights of others. That's how they became felons in the first place.
Kara, what do you think about that argument?
Well, first of all, I know there has been research done looking at rearrest rates among people with previous convictions and their voting practices. And we do see reduced rates of recidivism among people who do vote who have previous conviction records. I do think it's essential that we allow people with felony convictions to vote, particularly people who live in our community. 5.3 million people in this country cannot vote because of a felony conviction, and 4 million of those people are living in our communities. They're neighbors, they're, you know, friends and family members. And we are doing a disservice to them, to their families, and to the entire community if we choose to stigmatize them and ostracize them from the rest of society. It is to everyone's benefit to have people with felony convictions engaged in their civic life and contributing part of the community. It's a responsibility to vote. That is a good behavior that I think really should be encouraged rather than discouraged.
Kara, you're working directly to try to get some laws changed, and you have seen some laws change. What are the trends in that?
Well, there's been a lot of success over the last year, and it's the last 11 years, actually, and it's very encouraging. Last year, Governor Martin O'Malley of Maryland signed a law that restored voting rights to 52,000 people in the state of Maryland who have felony convictions and were previously disenfranchised. That state no longer disenfranchises people after the completion of their sentence. It automatically restores voting rights once an individual completes their sentence. In the state of Florida last year, Governor Charlie Crist changed their rules for nonviolent offenses, for people with nonviolent offenses who've completed sentence and have expedited the application process. In the last year, that state has reenfranchised over 100,000 people with felony convictions, and that's a really significant number, I think, particularly in such a short period of time. States like Rhode Island, which previously barred people on parole and probation from voting in 2006, there was a ballot measure where the voting public voted to restore voting rights to people with felony convictions, people on parole and probation. And 15,000 people gained their right to vote there. We're seeing in other states, like in Louisiana, just this year, Governor Jindal passed a notification bill, signed a notification bill that will let people know what indeed their right to vote is and notify mm-hmm. them once they can vote.
David, you mentioned that from your perspective, this is something that should be decided by the states. But hearing that many states are relaxing these laws, do you think that there should be legal challenges of any form to how the states are changing their laws?
Well, I think the states need to decide it for themselves. I think the federal government needs to stay out of it. This is a policy area that's reserved to the states by the 14th Amendment. So there may be debates within states, and I would encourage people to oppose loosening the standards, but I would also add that there should always be some fair set of guidelines for how a felon can get his or her voting rights restored on a case-by-case basis.
Do you know of any organizations that are actively working to lobby in cases where the laws are potentially changing?
Not off the top of my head.
What about the racial aspect? And I'm going to ask you first, David. The laws tend to be harsher in the Deep South, and many of the felony laws were developed between Reconstruction and Jim Crow during times of enfranchisement of African Americans. And it wasn't just about the laws that govern whether or not people could vote who were felons. It's also about what constituted a felony and how many people were deemed to be felons. Do you see a racial footprint in these laws?
Well, I would say that in the past, some of these laws have been unjust, but today, these laws are race neutral. You have to commit a serious offense before you get your voting rights taken away. So it's not like these laws are passed on the basis of someone's race. They're passed on crimes committed. And unfortunately, too many minorities commit crimes that fall under this area.
Kara, what do you see as racial impact?
Well, undeniably, there is a racial disparity in who is disenfranchised and who is not. 1.4 million African-American men in this country cannot vote. They're disenfranchised. That's 13% of all African-American men. Now, that's a large percentage of that population, and I think it's important to think about what that means for those communities, for African-American communities. Their voice is muted because they don't have full participation in the voting process. And I think that is undeniably a problem and something that we need to be concerned about.
Okay, Kara, if you were convicted in a state where it's difficult to become a voter again, but you move to another state that has different laws, whose laws apply?
You know, it differs from state to state. So it's hard, you know, there's no sort of universal rule. You know, some states you would assume that you move there and you are subject to the law of that state, but many states say no, it depends on what the previous state, the state of your conviction is from. So it's very confusing and complicated. You know, a federal bill actually was just recently introduced last month that hopes to sort of do some unification of these laws because it is very confusing and there is not consistency across the states. It applies only to federal elections, only to elections for federal office, and it would restore voting rights once an individual is released into the community and allow individuals to vote in federal elections.
David, when you think about this issue, there are so many things going on that have to do with the Supreme Court ruling over voter challenges, essentially, to the voter rolls and ACORN and investigations. How important is this felony voting issue? Is this something that you find important or, in the big picture, not a big deal?
Well, I think it's important, but I would also like to add that, you know, felony disenfranchisement prevents the diluting of votes in poor minority communities, because what happens is that the votes of the only people who are allowed to vote are law-abiding citizens. So I think there's a benefit there that we're sort of missing.
Well, on that note, David, Kara, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That was David Mulhausen, Senior Policy Analyst with the Heritage Foundation, and Kara Gotch, the Advocacy Director for the Sentencing Project. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. A lot is happening in the world of entertainment this week. Black comedians are getting some TV love, plus Time Out New York magazine is getting some heat. In an anniversary edition called New York 40, Jay-Z, Derek Jeter, and Juno Diaz were the only people of color out of 40 picks representing the culture mavens of the Big Apple. I spoke with our contributor Tanya Hart, host of the syndicated radio show Hollywood Live with Tanya Hart. I started by asking her if she'd seen this kind of thing before.
Boston Magazine did this, about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago. They did, you know, the most important people in Boston. And what happened, they got a lot of flack from everybody because they forgot to include African Americans, they forgot to include Asians, they forgot to include Latinas for the most part, and it was very lily white. And even though we know that Boston has always kind of had that image, that's just not really true and hasn't been for the last quarter of a century there. And so they got a lot of flack. But you know, at the end of the day, it always sells magazines. And I was not unconvinced that that was part of the reason anyway, because if you can get a buzz around something, then you get the controversy, then you get people talking about it, and you sell more magazines. So I really think it was partially a marketing ploy. And then what they did at the very end of that, after all that was over, they ended up getting a black governor, Deval Patrick, so they could never come back and say, okay, there are no black people influencing Massachusetts.
Well, we actually have with us Michael Friedson. He is the editor of Time Out New York. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good. Speaking of black governors, you guys have one, David Paterson, but you chose Elliot Spitzer as your cultural maven. So maybe that's a microcosm of your choices. How did you make that decision to choose the one over the other?
David Paterson is someone that we adore, along with, you know, dozens, thousands of other cultural minorities and people of all ethnicities that we cover every week. The purpose of this issue was just to distill, 40 people who are culturally, actively making a difference. And that the fact that we ended up with only three was, you know, let's be honest, it was a reflection of some of our editors here, but I'd like to think it's more of a reflection of New York. To be honest with you, for better or worse, we are turning a little bit Boston here. It's a little lily white. Now, that's not the way all of culture is here. You can see that any week in Time Out. I mean, we've covered, you know, this is like saying my best friend is black, but we've covered, you know, pretty much anybody of any color and any ethnicity in the magazine every single week. The fact is that those who are getting the most jobs, the most work, and the most face time out there, unfortunately, for better or worse, are the people that were sort of reflected on this list. And, you know, whether that's a good thing or not, we're following up in another story. Unfortunately, this list sort of advocated that idea.
Well, you had a letter in the magazine that basically said, well, this is how we justify our story, and very much along the lines of what you just told us. Mm-hmm. So you're being very upfront about your decision making, but there's list going around, these alternative list of like, okay, what about Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum? What about DJ mm-hmm. Reka, who started Basement Bhangra and basically brought Bhangra into the popular club lexicon? What about so-and-so? Why were there no Asians? Why were there, you know? And people are kind of making alternative lists. So
yeah.
Number one, do you think you should hire some of these people so that they actually can keep you informed? But number two, I mean, do you think that provocatively you're actually causing people to think about things? Because I having lived in New York for 10 years, but not being there right now, I never particularly envisioned it as a white cultural
sure.
nexus.
Yeah, me either. I'm with you, Farai, on that.
Whether or not we should hire the people who are making the alternative list, that will be part of a future story. We got such a feedback. You're right, it's not lily white, New York, but neither is the list if you really look at it. I mean, you know, we've got people who are second, third generations from everywhere. Tina Fey's mother is Greek. Bloomberg is
right.
Jewish. I mean, Tony Kushner's there, gay, lesbians. You know, in terms of diversity, I think judging people by their skin color, even if they're white-faced, is, you know, is just as bad. I'm not saying there's a lack of black faces out there, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, Michael, appreciate you making yourself available. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for your time, guys.
That was Michael Friedson, editor of Time Out New York. All right, I'm going to move back to you, Tanya. We have so many different things to talk about. I'm going to roll one up into two, like a little party sandwich. David Alan Greer, we had on the show about Chocolate News, and D.L. Hughley has been getting some love, too, for
yes,
a new show that's coming up.
Yes, he just signed a deal with CNN. How great is that? And actually, you know, everybody's trying to get this stuff on before the election. I think all of the programmers have realized how the Sarah Palin character that Tina Fey does has breathed new life and new ratings into SNL like we have not seen in decades. And so everybody wants to be on that bandwagon, and where else would you go but to the entertainers, you know, the black folks. And so CNN is putting D.L. Hughley on the 25th of October. I mean, that's how quickly this thing came out. He just, you know, the ink is not even dry yet. And, of course, David Alan Greer started his show. It premiered, I believe, it was one day this week. Chocolate News, which is a parody on all of the kind of black news shows that we saw back in the 70s and 80s. And it's totally irreverent. He totally offends everybody, as he says, and he doesn't care. But you probably will get a couple of laughs out of it. But it's very interesting how this is all coming around just before the election.
So, staying on the political and presidential tip, John McCain appeared on David Letterman last night, and the rumor mill kicked into gear about a Sarah Palin appearance on TV this weekend. Now, you have to understand that Senator McCain bailed on an appearance with the late-night host when he suspended his campaign because of the economy. Do you think that now that, you know, John McCain has come on Letterman, he's going to let up on the teasing? Letterman, that is.
I think David is, David's been around for a very long time. And all of these guys, you know, once you come on their show, they're very cordial. They're very nice to you. And I think he will be a good host in that sense. But I think he will make fun of him on the show. I really do. And if I were him, I would. You know, why not? If you got him there and he was so dissed by McCain, because it wasn't like, you know, he thought, oh, gosh, McCain's running off to take care of the economy, and actually he's doing an interview with Katie Couric and got terribly busted. You know, I don't know what he was thinking. It's like, somebody's going to see this. It's like all of a sudden politics and comedy have become synonymous. You cannot separate them anymore, and it's very much a part of how people get their information on candidates. And that's an entirely new phenomenon that we've never seen before.
Tanya, want to thank you.
My pleasure. It's always fun.
That was entertainment correspondent Tanya Hart, host of the syndicated radio show Hollywood Live with Tanya Hart.
I keep on falling in and I love.
Who can forget that intro to Alicia Keys' breakthrough 2001 hit Fallen from her debut album Songs in A Minor?
Sometimes I feel good, at times I feel used.
To date, the piano playing Keys has won over 80 music awards, including 11 Grammys. But her talent doesn't stop there. Last year, she made her film debut as Georgia Sykes in Smoke and Aces, followed by a role in The Nanny Diaries. Now she's back on the big screen starring with Queen Latifah, Jennifer Hudson, and Sophie Okonedo in The Secret Life of Bees. I caught up with Alicia promoting the film in New York and started by asking her about her latest role.
June Boyd is so incredible. I love her. I mean, I think that if you take yourself back to the 60s, smack in the middle of the beginning of the civil rights era, and really seeing the power of the country and the power of the people that really are making the country change, that's where you can find June Boyd. So she's a very strong woman. She's very independent. She is a person who's really loves her family very much. She's guarded. She's been hurt before, so that makes her extra guarded. She puts up a very tough exterior. It's a tough world, so she puts up a tough exterior. But underneath, she's really very vulnerable. She's really kind of, you know, really wants to love, but kind of is afraid of it and all sides of it.
Would you keep it down? Keep it down. I'm practicing.
Come over here. You're going to get wet.
In the movie, you get to see these different worlds, rich whites, poor whites, people who own land, people who work land, people who have dreams, people who don't have dreams. What is it about this story that you think is true? And I mean that in an emotionally true way. It is fiction, but what is it that stands out to you as true?
All of it is true, and I think that every character that you'll discover as you're watching the film is someone that you know or, you know, you can identify with yourself. You know, you have August, who's kind of the head sister. She's the matronly one, the one that keeps everything running, keeps everything smooth. She might remind you of a mother, of an older sister, of a grandmother even.
See, the world's really just one big bee yard, the same rules. Work in both places. Don't be afraid. As no life-loving bee wants to sting you.
You have Mae Boatwright, who's our other sister, who kind of has the whole weight of the world on her shoulders. When you see her, you know, the smallest little thing sets her off. You know, she's just a very sensitive soul, and I know, you know, everyone has met someone like that. You see Lily, someone who's, you know, young, coming of age, really trying to deal with her own demons and confusions. You see June, who is like, you know, someone who is again, in another, is coming into her own in a lot of ways and is really trying to change the world and fight for different rights. I think the entire movie is true, even with the onstart of you know, being of the time of being able to vote, especially in this climate that we're in right now politically. You know, it's like everything about it is true. It's a true part of history that I just think that the details of it you don't always get a chance to witness, and that's what's so exciting about this movie.
Your character, June, plays the cello, but it's not really, music is not a huge part of this movie. There's you, Queen Latifah, and Jennifer Hudson all in key roles. So what do you think it is that that the movie got out, or the audience might get out of seeing people who've really got one foot in the world of music and one foot in the world of acting?
I think that you'll just see the passion there, and I think that, you know, that just lends to the feeling of the passion, truly, the passion of acting, the passion of music, the way that music feeds life, you know, everyone's life, and so you'll see it. I know a lot of people are so shocked that we're all in it and, like, it's not a musical, but I think that's kind of the interesting part of it.
What was it like to work with the director, Gina Prince-Bythewood?
Gina is amazing. You know, she's the writer and the director of this, which is a no small feat, and she just did an amazing job. I love her demeanor. She's very no-nonsense, you know. At the same time, she really allowed us, she really was very focused on preparation. She would kind of do these improvisations with us that would just allow us to get to know each other's character better, you know, and on the spot, and it just gave us a certain freedom. You know, she gave us books and music and things to study and look into, movies, you know. She's definitely was super, super hands-on. And what was great about her is, like, because she's so no-nonsense, she pulls it out of you in a very inspiring way. But at the same time, she doesn't overdo it. So you know that if she likes it, you'll know. If she says she likes it, you know she really likes it, and that you did a good job, and so you feel proud of that.
All right, moving on to music. I don't go to a lot of award shows, but I was at the BET Awards, and you did this kind of ensemble piece with SWV, In Vogue, and TLC.
Oh, that was so, so fun. At the time, my single was called Teenage Love Affair, and it's off my album that's out now, As I Am. I really wanted to kind of do it like a girls group style because it has that feeling in the song. And so as we were talking about favorite girl groups of all time, you know, myself and my manager, Jeff Robinson, we start shooting out our favorite girl groups. So, you know, we start saying SWV and Vogue and TLC. And so when it came time for the BET Awards, it just felt like the right thing to do to kind of represent all these amazing, fantastic girl groups.
Well, just a couple more things. Very quickly, are you involved in anything around the election? You know, so many people from music, television, film are making their stamp on trying to get people out to vote. Are you involved with any of the groups?
Every day, no one in particular, but every day, every show, just urging people to vote. Every time that I'm able to have an opportunity to speak on television, I'm urging people to vote and get registered. Definitely do some private events with different people to help raise money for, I support Obama, so to raise money for his campaign. And I, you know, it's just like a constant thing to really see how the country is just so alert and involved in this election. I think that it's super important, and it's obvious that it's a time for a major change. So I'm really looking forward to the change coming, and I believe it will.
How have you changed between your 2001 album, Songs in A Minor, and your latest album, As I Am?
Oh, man, in the best ways, you know, just becoming more comfortable in my skin, you know, being more aware of the things that that come with this business and with balancing business and personal time, with creatively just being more expressive, being more free, all around the board. you know, just the lessons and the learning and the growing and just being way more inhibited, even just physically in regards to, you know, style and that kind of thing. You know, at first you come from a certain neighborhood, you're young, and you know you feel like there's a certain limit to the things that you would do, and then you realize that life is limitless. And I think that the more I live, the more that I realize that.
That was singer and actress Alicia Keys. She stars as June Boatwright in the film The Secret Life of Bees, which opens nationwide today. She joined us from New York, and here she is singing the theme tune to the new James Bond movie, Quantum of Solace. Yeah,